The whole world is now operating on the Grateful Dead's model because they never did very well in the record business, so they made their living playing. And they would record and they would play and sell their records and stuff, but it wasn't their principal source of income. And they were running that model, you know, way back in the 80s and stuff. And now the whole damn business has to run that way. I remember when Prince played at the Oakland Coliseum once, and everybody who bought a ticket to the show got a copy of the CD, which was an absolute inversion of the way the music business had been like 10 years earlier.
Musician, songwriter, and radio host David Gans joins John and Scoop on the Brewtopia podcast. We discuss his music career, his long-running radio show, The Grateful Dead Hour, independent music, and his long involvement with online community, The Well.
Welcome to another episode of the Plutopia News Network podcast. Our guest today is David Gans. And David's had quite a career. He's a musician. He's an author. He's a radio producer. He's based in Oakland. And aside from writing and performing his own music, he's an expert on the music of the Grateful Dead. Yeah. There's four books about the Dead and produced the nationally syndicated Grateful Dead Hour. How are you doing, David?
I'm doing fine, thank you. It's been a very interesting life becoming a famous Grateful Dead fan, you know. I never planned any of this stuff, and it turned out to be a career, which has been quite weird.
Yeah, I mean, how did you get connected to the Grateful Dead in the first place?
Started out as a fan. And I was a young musician in San Jose, California, and my songwriting partner had been trying to talk me into going to see the Dead for months, and he finally persuaded me to do it. And we took a massive dose of LSD and got a ride up to San Francisco, and it just pried my head open and started inserting new information into it. It just expanded my world as a songwriter and as a performer. You know, the music that they were doing was so much deeper than the stuff I'd been looking at and emulating up till then. And so I became a fan first. And because I was writing and I had always been writing, you know, just as a kid and stuff, I sort of wandered into music journalism as a way to enrich my musical life, meet people, learn stuff, and make connections. And so I started covering the Grateful Dead as my favorite subject. And I was working for a magazine out here called BAM, the California Music Magazine. And in 1976, when I started there, the Grateful Dead culture was already big enough and had enough mass to it to be the subject of a regular feature in the magazine. So they put me in charge of the Dead Ahead column. And I started going to the Grateful Dead office and hanging out there and talking with Eileen Law, who was their kind of interface with the fans and stuff. And I started meeting band members and I started interviewing band members, and that led to becoming friends with band members. And so my Grateful Dead, and I was playing Grateful Dead music with friends in bands, you know. I was never in a Grateful Dead copy band, but we were heavily influenced by the Grateful Dead and played a lot of their songs and stuff. So I was really steeped in it, but I was also having this regular mainstream music career. I was interviewing Rod Stewart and Pat Benatar and Fleetwood Mac for music magazines and stuff, but the Dead was my favorite subject. And a press junket to Jamaica in 1982 led to my meeting Peter Simon, the photographer and author, and that led to my being invited to do the text for Peter's book about the Grateful Dead.
Oh, you know, I recall we had an interview with Peter Simon on Inkwell, on the Well, some years ago. You set that up, didn't you?
Yeah. Peter and I became friends at that time and remained friends for the rest of his life. He passed away a couple of years ago. But John, so much of what happened to me in this life has been accidents and just good fortune, you know. And my interest in the Grateful Dead led to my becoming a Grateful Dead-oriented journalist, and that led to being getting to do this book. And that led to my appearing on the KFOG Deadhead Hour, becoming part of the team that produced that show, and then later being asked to take over sole responsibility for that show, because the original host of it was the morning drive guy and seriously overworked and all. Plus, I published a book on the subject, so I was kind of an established expert.
Is that show still happening?
Sorry?
Is that show still happening?
Yes.
The Grateful Dead Hour?
I was doing the KFOG Deadhead Hour and still doing my freelance music writing, but other radio stations started calling and asking if they could carry the show. And so without my ever having planned or even had an ambition to do so, this radio show became nationally syndicated. I went to the Dead and said, look, there's interest in this show and I love doing it. May I continue? And they said, yes. And I wound up making a business arrangement with them. And I'm still producing this show. It became a national show of its own accord, really. And eventually I did a year of syndication with a real syndication company, and that led to my becoming a corporation, and I'm still doing all that, but I'm still producing and hosting that show and distributing it myself now, 36 years later. I never planned to do any of it.
Well, on SiriusXM, you're connected with that too, aren't you?
Yes. When they started the channel in 2007, the Grateful Dead organization urged them to hire me to help them create the channel. So I was the consultant that they hired, and I helped design the programming week and pointed them at the people that they hired to host programs on it. And in January of 2008, they decided they wanted to try doing what they thought they called a roundtable show, a talk show. And we thought we'd have a guest expert of some kind and have a specialized conversation about a given topic each week. But the first one was so much fun and so unstructured that we just decided to make it a general purpose talk show and make it weekly. It was originally going to be like a once a month thing or whatever, but it just took off and it's been really fun. And my old friend Gary Lambert and I are the co-hosts on it, and we're similar enough in style and taste to not have a lot of conflict on the air, but different enough to keep it interesting in our approach. And we just throw the phones open and people tell stories and ask questions, and we have guests, we have musicians come in and tell their stories and stuff too. It's just been really fun. But John, I never in my life thought that this was going to wind up being my career.
You were quite fortunate to be a fan of the Grateful Dead simply because they're one of those rare big artists that are accommodating, like the freedom they gave you to do the show and to play a lot of music that people, other artists, wouldn't let you have access to the archives.
Yeah, they gave me access to the archives, actually, from the very beginning, which kind of blew my mind. I was in the vault, the famous Grateful Dead vault, before anybody else was getting in there, before they started releasing stuff from there. Yeah.
Who makes those recordings? Or who made those recordings?
Well, various people along the way. In the very beginning, when the Grateful Dead started, they had a very important patron by the name of Owsley Stanley, who also provided the incredibly high quality LSD that they used for their explorations. Yes. And Owsley was very serious about everything, including audio engineering. And he brought his voice at the theater, Altex, from home to the Fillmore and really essentially invented the first rock and roll sound system by seeing to it that they had better equipment to sing and play through. And so Bear recorded the tapes in the early years, and then when he moved on to other things, various other people, they started recording the shows. Bear wanted to record them so that he could evaluate his work as the sound man right out in the house. And the band wanted to listen to their improvisations and critique them and see what they were doing that worked and maybe even harvest musical ideas from the improvisations. So they very early on formed the habit of recording their shows. And also very early on, hobbyists and fans began recording their shows. There were audiophiles in the very early days. One gentleman by the name of Harry Ely, who died some years ago, I knew him. He was just an audiophile, and he would bring his recorder to shows all the time and record the concerts that he heard. And this was before bootleg records and stuff, before it all became like a fraught matter. And then with the Dead, they fairly early on, at least some of the people in the Grateful Dead organization, realized that allowing the tape trading was great marketing for them. I mean, you know, they always bucked the common wisdom of the music business, because they didn't thrive by the music business's rules. They didn't make records and sell them and then tour to support their albums. They toured to make a living and made records for the fun and occasional income boost of it. But, you know, their model became the model for the whole industry after music sales dried up in the last few years. But in those days, they were doing this other thing, and recognized that their audience was in it with them, that without an audience, they were nothing. And so they treated their audience with more respect and treated them. I got a line in one of my songs that says, "Treat your customers like neighbors, not the other way around." And that's what the Grateful Dead did.
Yeah, they were wise to have that policy of letting the fans record and not making it a big hassle, because I've heard some old bootleg recordings done of other artists, and people had to smuggle stuff in and surreptitiously record, and most of it was just horrible quality. But if you give people a little space, some of those fan recordings I've listened to were just amazing.
Well, in 1984, the Grateful Dead, after fighting it, and very different factions, like the Crew, were all like, "Oh boy, let's go out there with tin snips and cut those recorders cables," you know. And then other people were more like, "Oh, come on, man." Jerry was like, "Hey, once we're done with it, you can have it." And Dan Healy, who was the front of house man for the Dead from 1976 till 94 or so, had a relationship with those tapers. He was interested in helping them and interested in hearing their work. He wanted to hear what these recording guys, he wanted to hear their recordings of his PA and wanted to hear what they sounded like and stuff. So he developed a more symbiotic relationship with the tapers that were good at their job. And eventually the Grateful Dead decided that rather than fight this, they would make it legit. They would bring it in-house by selling special tickets in a special section so the tapers could all hang out with each other and they weren't shushing their audience members next to them who were trying to enjoy the show, which had been a problem earlier, right? So from October 84 on, they allowed taping, and you would buy a special ticket and you could bring your gear in and not have to smuggle it and all that stuff, because they finally recognized and embraced it as insanely good viral marketing before that term even existed. I have played with various members of the Grateful Dead at various times, but I certainly never got on stage with the Grateful Dead per se, and I never got to play with Jerry, but I've been on stage with Bob Weir, Phil Lesh, Bill Kreutzmann, Donna Jean Godshow, Mickey Hart, and Vince Welnick, and Bruce Hornsby once. But enough to feel like, yeah. I played some gigs with Phil Lesh in 97 after Jerry passed. The end of 97 and early 98, Phil came and joined me and my band for some benefit concerts. So, and that was kind of one of the high points of my life, was having Phil, you know, being on stage with him jamming, where I put a band together for him to jam with. That was pretty damn high, you know, as you can imagine.
Well, you got started in music journalism with BAM magazine, is that correct?
Yeah.
We started, I guess, about the same time. I was a political reporter for Zodiac News Service in San Francisco for quite a while, and finally just burned out, and they allowed me to be music editor starting about 1976. So we probably were covering a lot of the same shows. But that was just,
you know, the other Scoop in the area, Scoop Nisker?
Yeah, I met him a few times. I got the name Scoop from being at Pacifica Radio out in Houston when we were getting bombed.
Oh,
and
PFD.
Yeah, I was a news director out there. So they didn't like my real name is Charles, and they didn't think Charles was sexy enough, so.
I never knew that.
Well, Wesley Nisker also decided to take on a canonical newsman kind of name, and it served him very well. Now he's more of a teacher of Buddhism. He still does a little bit of media, but he teaches at a Buddhist center and stuff. He's a very interesting man, Scoop Nisker.
Yes.
Yeah, my only correspondence with him ever was about Buddhism. I think he sent me a couple of issues of, I think it was called the Insight Times.
Inquiring Mind.
That's it.
I think Vipassana is his.
Yeah, it's Vipassana. Yeah. That's definitely his practice.
Yeah.
And he's still engaged with that then.
Yeah. I don't know if he's still the editor of Inquiring Mind, but I've run into him at a coffee shop nearby occasionally. He's a lovely guy.
He made those great news collages.
I learned from him. In fact, that was one of my inspirations. When I first started doing radio at KFOG, it was cutting tape. And I had quarter-inch tape at home and stuff, so I had learned how to edit tape already. But I was very much inspired by Scoop Nisker's montages and started doing little, you know, cut together little bits of movie dialogue and stuff like that. I eventually stopped doing it because, of course, I was younger. I was sort of hornier to do stuff, you know, in those days. And over time, my radio style sort of settled down, and I eventually came to the understanding that people were tuning in to hear the Grateful Dead, not me. So eventually, I sort of receded from my creative participation in it, and it became more of a presenter of their music and stuff. But I still do a little montage every week of the music, you know, from next week's show. I do a little scenes from next week. So I still cut tape, but it's now on a screen instead. But it's using that stuff that I learned from Scoop with like really quick cuts of short things to put something big together. It was really fun.
So I want to divert a little bit from the Grateful Dead. We might come back to that later, but I want to talk about The Well.
Yeah.
And one of the things I want to say about The Well, I mean, we should really promote The Well here. Whole Earth Electronic Link. I joined The Well in, it formerly says 1990. I think I had joined once before then and then left and then came back. But my recollection is that the first person I ever had a conversation with on The Well where it was just a one-to-one conversation was David Gans.
It was?
Yeah, do you remember that?
I don't.
I had mentioned that I could not find the Auto Salvage album. It was out of print. And you contacted me, I think through talk on The Well. You told me, oh, well, I have that album. I can send you a copy of it, cassette. So you sent me a cassette with Auto Salvage on one side and Crazy Fingers on the other side.
All right.
Yeah, it was great. And that's when I really kind of got the experience of what kind of community we were in, that somebody who didn't even know me would, you know, do that for me. And, you know, kind of rolling forward to now, we have a common friend through The Well whose apartment burned like to a crisp, you know, burned completely down. And The Well, through contributions on The Well and people connected to people on The Well, how much money have we raised for that guy right now?
I have a separate PayPal account that I use to collect and disperse money for these sorts of things, just because I'm a member of so many different communities and have such reach that I'm a good person to go out and do stuff because I have access to a lot of people. And I started collecting money for Pete like immediately after we got the news. And in less than 24 hours, we'd collected more than $10,000. And as of this morning, I have passed $24,000 along to him. And there's a few hundred more collecting now. And more people have sent checks directly to him. So we don't know exactly how much yet, but I have personally passed along more than $24,000 to him that all came from members of The Well. No structure, nothing. They just sent the money along, didn't wait for a, there's no 501c3 vetting this stuff and issuing you know, receipts for exemptions. People just sent the money.
We should mention that Pete was like the guy who managed the technology for The Well for many years.
Yeah, he was our system operator for many, many years. He was our programmer. He basically kept the operation running. And it, as such, is, you know, the nexus of tremendous gratitude and appreciation on an ongoing basis. He left the position a couple of years ago because he needed a better paying job, I think, for his own life. But he stayed on as a member of the community and consulting with his successors and is still a very vital part of our team. But this is by no means the first time any of this kind of thing has been done. The Well has been doing this the entire time we've been doing it. When Mike Godwin's had a fire.
A book fire on the road.
That's right. We put together a campaign to replace his books, not just to raise money, but people sent him books from our personal collections to rebuild his library. That kind of stuff there has been more ad hoc philanthropy in that community than you could possibly imagine. More good things have been done for more people in that world. And I it's not utterly unique as an online community, but it has certain attributes, I think, that foster this sort of thing. And one of them is identity and accountability. From the very beginning, people needed to be themselves. There have been very, very few pseudonym accounts allowed, and it was for famous people, you know, who sort of wanted to be incognito in here. But very few exceptions have been made to that rule. Everybody has to have their real identity attached to who they are on the well. So there's none of that anonymous drive-by character assassination that so pollutes the public free internet, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's so different from something like Facebook or Twitter. And those of us who got our start on the well as in like communicating online or even on Usenet before that and on bulletin board systems and so forth, we're used to the idea of being in a community where people sort of persist with each other and have conversations that persist. And drive-by is a good word for the kind of conversations that you see on Facebook or Twitter or whatever. And it seems to me that if there were more systems like the well and fewer systems like Facebook and Twitter, we might have a more civil society right now.
Well, that's
polarization.
We've had occasional invaders of right-wing insanity and stuff, but they don't last long in our world because our culture is fairly evidence-based and stuff. You know, people, it's a text-only system, so you can't really baffle people with bells and whistles and stuff. You have to deliver the information, and people that come in and sort of make, you know, nasty slams on people and stuff don't last long because we prefer civility in that world.
Yeah, I mean, we do have arguments and flame wars and so forth. Though a lot of the people who are on the well now have been there for quite a while, and it feels like there's a real sort of maturity there that might have been less the case, you know, 20 years ago.
Well,
but people are really,
John, huh? When I joined the well, my user ID was Mad Dog.
Oh, I remember
and
that.
I took that name because at the time it was when you need to come up with a handle when you get online. And the only other nicknames I could think of were the nasty ones my brother had used on me when I was a fat kid. So I didn't want to use any of those names. And Mad Dog was a name that had been briefly given to me in a band when I was about 22 years old. I was in a band with a bunch of vocal majors from Cal State Hayward, and they were fairly rigid about certain things. And I had no sense of structure and rules and stuff. I was just this hippie guitar player. So they would lay these rules on me about, well, you know, no double stops in the bass or no open fifths and all this stuff. And I would sort of, oh, every once in a while I'd lose my shit and just, what are you yelling at me about? Blah, blah, blah. So one of those, the guys in the band was, Mad Dog Gans is back. So when I signed onto the well, that was the name that I gave myself as a user ID, but I changed it. 3 or 4 years into it, I changed my user ID because I decided I didn't want to be that guy anymore. I had to make some changes in my life. I had to finish growing up and learn how to become a proper adult. And the well helped me do that because I came in with guns blazing and being a volatile and occasionally sort of violent interactor with people. And I got tired of being that guy. And I went to work seeing a therapist and stuff and sort of becoming a more integrated person, which I needed to do in order to become qualified to do stuff like marry this amazing woman that I married to, Rita Herault, who's also a well user. But my point is that I was one of those people who was sort of probably an attractive nuisance in that causing train wrecks wherever he goes kind of person. And I stopped being that kind of person. And it's funny, in retrospect, in recent years, I think that I may have cost the well some users over time by being less of a source of drama. I think there might have been some people who were there, in particularly in the Grateful Dead world, to listen to me whining about my problems in that culture and stuff like that. And as I eventually became happier, less unhappy, less angry, less volatile. I probably became significantly less entertaining in my online dealings. So I became a happier and milder citizen of the well and less of a sort of tabloid attractant. And over time, the well became less populated with that kind of stuff anyway. And now, as you say, I think we still have flame wars, but they're fairly mild and they're fairly short in duration because most of us are used to each other. And I certainly became less reactive. I finally learned to not respond to an insult with an insult. And I finally learned that I didn't have to take up every single cause and avenge every single wrong. And I didn't need to challenge every single questionable statement that people made. And so, you know, I managed my own participation and I took my user ID, TNF is my user ID, which is the initials of my business, Truth and Fun Incorporated. And I chose that because I specifically wanted to have a name that wasn't a, didn't come, you know, step in. Like Mad Dog was a, you know, you want to fight me, buddy? That was what Mad Dog said. TNF is like, oh, hi.
You know? Oh, yeah. I mean, I didn't realize how alike we had been. I had a chip on my shoulder from time to time on the well and certainly got into fights, flame wars, and that sort of thing. Got really frustrated, got really defensive. But one thing I'll say about that, and I think you probably agree with me, being a member of that community helps you get past that stuff.
Yes.
And helps you realize not to post while you've been drinking, that sort of thing.
Well, that was never an issue for me. I've never been a drinker, but that there are people that you and I both know over the years that we can go, oh yeah, it's definitely after 5 o'clock where he is, yeah, that kind of thing. But yeah, I learned so much from the well, not just you know, from rubbing shoulders with academics and professionals in all these fields and stuff. And I think that's one of the most important things about the well is that we have experts from so many different disciplines that can come into a conversation. We have military, industrial, scientific, educational. We have zillions of people with tremendous expertise sharing their stuff. It's not a specialized conversation. It's a generalized conversation with lots of people like that. And also, I just had really good teachers and people who would be examples of how to behave. People that would show me, you know, you don't really need to react to everything that goes by. So sitting on your hands is an important practice in a place where typing is a performing art.
Yeah, exactly. And you learn, one of the things you learn is that when you come into a space that you're not completely familiar with, you don't just kind of blather in and start shooting your mouth or typing your fingers off, I guess, but you take some time to listen and to hear what people are how they relate. Like, we have different areas on the well that we refer to as conferences, which are like main subject areas, and they have conversations in them that we call topics. And if you join a conference that you haven't been part of before, you can really make trouble for yourself if you come in with guns blazing. I've learned not to do that.
Yeah. Also, I think that you just brought up a very important aspect about the well that helps to differentiate it. Like, the well is organized around subject matter. And Facebook is organized around people. You know, it's personal pages. And I mean, I run a lot of pages for my radio show and stuff like that, too. But, you know, I think the structure is different. It's the usual Facebook participant is on his own page, posting his own stuff and all, you know. So it's organized around personalities rather than around subject matter. That's and I think the fact that ours, that the well is divided up into topic areas and has, you know, specific topics. There's granularity within each area and there's large general areas, you know, like I'm not that interested. Like, I'm not a programmer, so I don't go to the software conference. I don't need to go to the software conference. There's nothing for me to learn or contribute in the software conference. But, you know, we started a Grateful Dead conference in 1986. That was, you know, that was our contribution to bring this topic to the well. And it grew so fast, and there were people that bought computers so they could get online, which was a very cool thing in 1986, 87, right?
Well, but deadheads were a big part of the early, well on, though. Were they like solicited, invited to be part of the well, or did they just kind of find their way to it? Here's how it started.
Mary Eisenhart was the editor of Micro Times magazine and a big deadhead, and she was a friend of mine. And a friend of hers, Bennett Falk, who was a columnist at Micro Times, also a big deadhead. I was hanging out with them in the mid-80s, and Mary mentioned one night that there was this new conferencing thing beginning to happen. I mean, at this point, I think CompuServe existed. And I don't even know what the other services were at the time, but Stuart Brand was starting this new thing called The Well as an extension of the Whole Earth Software catalog, and they're offering free accounts to people. And Mary thought we might want to start our own online system for deadheads, but she suggested that we kind of workshop the idea in The Well, that they would give us free accounts because we had an interesting idea for online community. So we did that. And in fact, I just posted on my Facebook page a couple of weeks ago the flyer that we passed out outside of a dead show in March of 86, inviting people to what we call the Virtual Village Green. And we knew from conversations we'd had, like John Perry Barlow was one of the Grateful Dead's lyricists, and he taught me about community in our first interview in 82. He said, look, a community, this is a community. And he described a community as being, out where he lived in Wyoming. He said, you might not like your neighbor, but if you get your ass in a sling, he's going to be here to help you. That's what community is about. And he recognized that the dead community was a community without a physical location, but it was a community just the same. So we built on that idea, and we were handing out these flyers asking people to get online and join a community. We used that word from the very beginning, and it was one from the very beginning because it was already a community. It just needed to migrate into cyberspace. But there's another thing. We weren't the first ones at all. When Usenet began some years earlier, one of the very, very first non-technical news groups to ever exist on Usenet was a Grateful Dead news group. Because there happened to be a lot of deadheads in the telecom world, in the academic world, and even in the military world. So they found each other before when it was ARPANET, I think there were deadheads talking to each other in news groups as well. So the Grateful Dead was, in a way, one of the killer apps for online community from day one. And we proved that. Without even intending to, just by starting this community and have it grow immensely. And various people who are historians of The Well and stuff credit our group with having provided enough income to keep the thing, going through its early years. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. And the Grateful Dead Conference is no longer the potent nexus that it was, because that whole thing diffused into the whole world once they started their own online service in 95 or so. People started to migrate away from The Well in terms of the Grateful Dead, but it didn't matter because the Well is already there in our community. And many of the friendships that formed there still exist. Many of my favorite people in the entire world are friends that I met in The Well and 30 some years ago.
Yeah, same here. The character of The Well, I guess, changes over time as people leave and new people come. I mean, not the fundamental of the community and how it operates, but just kind of like the kinds of conversations you have depend a lot on people who show up, people who are in the room. And we've had, I know that we have one conference where we recently added a rule that people were, well, it was controversial. People weren't sure what they thought about it. It had to do with bringing in content from outside and posting it in there. But when we discourage people from doing that and they kind of stop doing it, it's kind of changed the character of that particular conference, and it felt like it was a lot more conversational after that it wasn't just a lot of cut and paste.
I am sort of in the middle on that question, because a lot of the guy who was doing a lot of what they call paste bombing became controversial because a lot of people didn't like seeing that many excerpts from news articles and stuff. But I thought he started a lot of important conversations by bringing those things in. the new hosting team wanted to adjust the parameters of how things are presented in that conference and asked that shorter excerpts, bearing in mind the possibility of fair use violations, but not really intending to make that a legal prohibition, but just to sort of modify the culture a little bit so that there was less text being brought in from outside, more of a précis of the piece that you're linking to rather than a lengthy excerpt from it. And that was the way to sort of finesse changing the rule without squashing the conversation. And it's still being proved out, I think. We're only a few weeks into that new system. And I don't think that the conversation has become any less robust. I feel like maybe we could have a few more topics being started by that kind of thing. But it seems like we've survived that hiccup in the culture a little pretty well.
Yeah, I mean, as a member of that hosting team, I can say that our intention was not to eliminate cut and paste, but just to have really short excerpts.
Yeah, no, I
because
agree.
Those big and blocks of text were kind of like rocks in the road, you know?
Yes, I understand that. And I certainly endorsed the request that the excerpts be shorter. In my own practice, I also bring articles in from outside, but I was always in the habit of posting less, a shorter excerpts, but I've been called on it a couple times by one of the co-hosts, and I'm happy to comply, and I'll go back and remove that post and redo it. You know, like the request sometimes is, instead of posting four paragraphs from that, how about a sentence from you explaining what's in it? And I'm happy to do that. You know, I feel like it's my obligation, if I'm bringing something in, to explain why it's valid, not just drop a big block of information in and walk away. So I appreciated the guidance, and I feel like most people are complying with it.
Yeah, I mean, it's just to keep the emphasis more on the conversation among people there, and not necessarily have so much stuff coming in from the outside. But kind of my point about that was that a change like that can kind of change the character of the conversation. And I think that was probably an extreme situation. You don't see changes that have as big an impact as that in conferences necessarily. But kind of the point is that so much depends on who shows up and the kinds of conversations that they want to have. I mean, the conversation we're talking about was originally supposed, or the conference we're talking about was originally supposed to be about how stories are represented in media, you know, sort of how media handles things. But really, it's just become about the stories themselves, and it's become a kind of a catch-all conference where all kinds of things are being discussed.
Well, that's because the media brings us all that stuff. You have to, you're talking about the media and talking about what the media delivers. It's kind of makes sense, you know, and it's impossible. We've been herding cats on the well for 30 some years now. And it's a fool's errand to try and keep things rigidly on track. And it also squashes conversations. So, you know, how you police the edges of the discourse is the challenge of hosting. You know, how do you do it without annoying people or just chasing them off altogether while maintaining keeping the conference sort of trim and purpose driven as it needs to be.
You're an independent musician. You have created some fine recordings that you sell as an independent artist. How tough is it these days to be an independent artist, and how was it impacted by the COVID shutdown?
Well, that's a really good question. And it's been fascinating. I have found, I made a little niche for myself. Everything that I do has become harder to make a living at. Journalism, books, articles, photography, radio, music, everything. But I've managed to sort of synergize all of my various things. I mean, having two national radio shows is a tremendous advantage for a musician, because I can announce my tours and my gigs and even occasionally slip one of my own songs into the radio show so people can hear me. I have, obviously, since I'm doing two Grateful Dead oriented things, I can't make them about me. So I have to be very careful how I put that information into that stream. But I do have access to a national audience, which helps immensely. I've also been online since 1985. So I took to this, like, for example, some years ago, people would say to me, like in the early days of Facebook, people would say, well, how do you get, how do you use Facebook to market your music and stuff? I told this guy he should go back in time 10 or 15 years and already be online when this new thing happened. So you knew how to interact with people. Like, the old model of music stardom was to be a mysterious figure that people saw on stage and on the album cover and maybe in a magazine article, but otherwise had no access to. And now it's all about schmoozing and access and meet and greets and stuff. One of my running jokes about the current music culture is, would there be a Steely Dan today if Donald Fagen had had to do meet and greets to launch their career?
That would have
like
been
Bob
interesting.
Dylan. How, you know, you just can't picture Bob Dylan working the room, you know, like I do all the time. I play house concerts. I love being with people. I'm a schmoozer. I'm a total extrovert. So this is, I've been online forever, so I jump right into this stuff. I'm fine with it. I'm an oversharer kind of in a certain way, and I have a direct relationship with my audience right now. I'm sort of dancing around the answer to your question because how I got to today is interesting. Once when the shutdown began in March of last year, my busiest month ever was going to be April of 2020. I had like 20 dates booked in that month, and one by one they came undone and got rolled up and put away. And then the rest of my year got rolled up and put away. On April 4th of last year, I sat there for a while, going, okay, what the hell am I going to do with myself now? And I saw people started doing online concerts and stuff. And I thought, I can do that. I've got the equipment. I've got some equipment. I can do that. And I looked for a time to schedule an online show, you know, and I just like everybody from the top down was doing streams. And I thought, okay, if I wait for a moment when nobody's doing anything else, I'm never going to play. So starting on April 4th of last year, I just said, I'm going to play every day. I'm going to get on my Facebook page, D Gans Music, and I'm going to play a set. And we'll see who shows up. I'll pass the hat, see how it goes. And I've played every day with maybe a dozen exceptions. My wife and I took a few days off to go camping last summer, and I missed a day for my colonoscopy and a few other things along the way. But I have played more than 400 shows online, and it made a few bucks. Almost every single day, some contributions have come in. And it's not primarily for the money, but some money has come in to help keep my business afloat and make up for the revenue I've lost from not being able to play gigs and sell stuff at my merch table. It also motivated me to finally get off my ass and start an online store, which I now have, perfectable.net. So I'm selling stuff in my online store, which has been great. But I pivoted to staying home and doing it every day. And it's been wonderful. There's a group of a couple of dozen regulars who come every single day. They attend every one of my shows. It's been a beautiful thing. We had a birthday party online, a surprise Zoom party for one of the ringleaders of that group the other night. And it was just a wonderful, wonderful experience. These people have been so great. And everything that I would want in life as a musician, to have people quoting my song lyrics in their, you know, talking about their lives and stuff, is like, that's like why I came to this planet, you know? That kind of stuff has been happening. And I've made enough money that it makes a difference in my income, and enough money that I kind of can't afford to stop doing it, which is fine because I'm enjoying doing it. I just pivoted to doing it online because it's absurdly easy to get online on Facebook Live. It's ridiculous. I've resisted the opportunity or the temptation to expand it. You know, I don't do TikTok and I don't do YouTube. I just do this because I'm not ambitious enough or driven enough to try and expand it and make, more money from it. I'm making enough money to do it, and I'm enjoying the hell out of it as it is. And so I don't have the ambition to try to expand it, which might cost me some of the energy and magic of the way it is now. I'm just enjoying it as it is.
Yeah, I remember a time in the music business where artists relied on their record sales to survive.
And touring was to drive record sales.
Right.
Now it's the opposite.
It's flipped. You know, if you don't have merch and you don't have a tour, you're going to have to go out and get a job somewhere because it's hard to get income other ways.
Yeah. And to circle back to the Grateful Dead, this is the whole world is now operating on the Grateful Dead's model because they never did very well in the record business, so they made their living playing. And they would record and they would play and sell their records and stuff, but it wasn't their principal source of income. And they were running that model, you know, way back in the 80s and stuff. And now the whole damn business has to run that way. I remember when Prince played at the Oakland Coliseum once and everybody who bought a ticket to the show got a copy of the CD, which was an absolute inversion of the way the music business had been like 10 years earlier.
Well, if the emphasis is on getting record contracts, first of all, you have to be palatable to the record company, and then you have to accept the fact that they control the finances, and their bookkeeping might be a little weird. You know, I recall hearing I think it was a forensic accountant that was interviewed that had been involved in a lot of lawsuits of artists against record companies, and he said he had never once looked at the books of a record company where they weren't cheating the artist.
I expect that's true. And I've talked to various other people who worked in business affairs. And like I met a woman once who had worked for a label and said that anytime they ever had to cut a check to an artist, there was an alarm sound. It's like, what are we doing wrong? We actually have to pay somebody. And then she joined the management of an artist and started doing audits for him. And she told me stuff amazing. I don't want to name names, but various artists who had never made a nickel from super successful records and stuff because the business was structured to deny payment to creative people. And now, I mean, I grew up in the world of like Steve Goodman, John Prine, Jackson Browne, everybody recording each other's songs and playing on each other's albums. And that's kind of what I wanted to be, was a songwriter, right? And then I became this hippie jam band musician, which is a whole different way of doing things. And now that thing doesn't work anymore of people recording each other's songs. Just the other day, a friend of mine sent me a recording of him doing one of my songs. And it's only like the fourth or fifth time in my entire life that has happened. Which isn't an indictment of my songwriting skill. It's an indictment of the way the business works these days.
I'm a royalty owner. I administer royalties for a band that I managed in the Bay Area years ago, and still get the occasional checks. I won't mention any names, but their initials are UMG. I think I just did. And there has been a lot of strange behavior by the majors. You know, they've all consolidated. You know, there used to be many record labels. Now there's basically just a few when you talk about the big labels. But the bookkeeping there has been very strange. And one thing that's hurting a lot of musicians that have a recording catalog has been the change in the way streaming has been paying out. You know, there's been a lot of people who say, you know, they're just not getting anything approaching what they used to get from, like, the radio royalties and things like that.
Yeah, I get a statement a couple times a year for my share of stuff like Amazon streaming and whatever, and it's absurd the amounts of money that an artist at my level receives zero functionally dollars from stuff like Spotify. I treat it like the weather. I can't do anything about it, and it occasionally helps me and occasionally it doesn't. Being searchable on Spotify matters, you know, having my stuff. I sell my records through the Amazon Advantage program, which takes a punitive share of the money. But being in Amazon, being visible on Amazon, helps identify me as an actual artist and stuff. So I treat that stuff like the weather, and I don't worry about it, and I cash those pathetic little $2.40 checks from BMI when they arrive. And I just understand that that's the way it is now, and that old model of income for people. Even the songwriters, you know, you'd make money off the songwriting. Radio airplay, you'd get paid every time your song got played, even when the artist didn't get paid every time that same song got played. That whole model is also evaporated over the years. I mean, I guess the artists still get paid for their airplay, but airplay is, you know, radio is disintegrated into this horrible business run by hedge fund managers with zero regard for creativity, you know, in a lot of commercial radio in particular. Now I'm just ranting. So let's.
Do you think you would, if we were in the old world where you were making records for a record company and those records were getting distributed by them and you were getting, you know, paid based on sales of recordings and also radio play, do you think in that world you would have made more money from music than you're making now?
I don't know. I don't know that my music would have been popular enough. I mean, I've had this amazing good fortune of being able to just do whatever the fuck I want for 30 plus years, 50 years, really, as a musician. Because the first thing I ever played on a guitar was a song that I wrote myself with my brother's help. I was never like a guitar geek. And I never did that thing of becoming obsessed with various styles and learning all these tunes. I mean, I learned tons of songs by other people and stuff, but I was always more interested in my own voice. I acquired a lot of stuff from other places and copied things and stole licks from various places and all, but I was always more interested in just telling my own story. And I when I was very young, I worked with a wannabe music publisher for a little while, and he took me in and made demos and stuff, and he tried to sell my songs, and he just never had any luck. And after I became a deadhead, I just started playing that kind of music and stopped really seriously pursuing any sense of, like, you know, like, I mean, I just never really formed a plan to become like a recording artist or anything, because that didn't seem like, I don't know. I took the path instead in the mid-70s of becoming a journalist and seeing what I could learn and all that kind of stuff along the way, and maybe diluted my musical focus a little bit. But it all worked out great, because I took this like 20-year detour into broadcasting and writing books and stuff like that. When I came back to my own music after Garcia died, and I thought maybe the Grateful Dead thing might wind down, ha ha ha. I thought, maybe I'll go back to my own stuff. That's when I started touring nationally and becoming more serious about being a performer. And by that time, the idea of getting a record deal was kind of quaint. And I already knew after the years of covering the business what a completely crooked industry it was. So I kind of stopped even thinking about wanting to have a real record deal. Oddly enough, right now, I have two projects in the can that I would like to find a real label to release. Just because it would be fun to do it properly and to get some real attention, like maybe get reviewed and things like that, and maybe have somebody else do the marketing for it instead of having to do every single thing myself. Now, I've done okay. I've sold 4,000 of my own records in the last 10 years up through at gigs and through mail order and stuff. And that's, and I've, you know, all of my records have been profitable on a modest level. So I'm doing fine as a completely independent, unaffiliated artist. But it would be fun. One of the records is an improvisation session with my cousin, who's a cellist. And it's a record of pure improvisation, no structures at all, no songs. And it's beautiful. The people that love it have really loved it and stuff. So I want to, like, see if I can get a legit label, some nice obscure arcane label to release this obscure arcane record of acoustic improvisation, just for the interesting experience of seeing if that gets us anywhere. And also in hopes that maybe we can line up some gigs for my cousin and me to play, to go out on stage and do what we did in the studio so successfully the very first time we ever played music together. The other project is the first record I ever made with my friend Eric Rollins, which was released in 1997. I got the ADATs out, transferred them into the computer, and remixed it and re-recorded some stuff. So I want to do a 25th anniversary reissue of this album, which has a lot of famous people playing on it. David Grisman plays on three tracks. The great pedal steel player Bobby Black plays on two tracks and stuff. So I'm kind of thinking I might be able to talk a label into releasing this great special 25th anniversary record of an album you never heard of. But if I don't get deals for them, that's fine. I'll put them out myself. I'll finance them myself. I've had successful Kickstarters for a number of records. I mean, I've played the system well by being realistic, by taking advantage of all the tools that I have available to me, and by not being greedy and not being foolish and not being ambitious, by just wanting to do what I can, make the most of. And also, I think another one of the important things about my approach is that I would rather do the work than put a lot of energy into selling the work. You know, I've done what I've had to thrive, but never really invested the extra that it would take to maybe take it to the next level, because I'd rather just be doing the work.
I guess the question is, if you got a major label, well, a minor label, even to do the publishing, what do you really gain? Is it mostly just the marketing part of it? I mean, distribution isn't what it used to be, because you're not selling like a piece of fixed media. You're mostly selling online, right?
I expect that I will be my own best outlet for whatever that is, even if a label puts it out. And it would just be nice to be somebody else's recording artist instead of having to do every single thing myself. I've never had a manager. I've had booking agents at various times, but I've really been a one-man operation all this time. And I just think it would be fun to have somebody else take an interest in the record, put their creativity into it, and put their marketing chops into it, and see if we can't do something that gets some real attention. You know, I entered the NPR Tiny Desk contest this year for the first time.
Oh, wow.
Just because, why the hell not? I mean, why ignore all that stuff? Go ahead and, you know, it cost me nothing to enter, and what the hell, if I make the finals or whatever, it'll be good for my visibility and stuff. But I don't like to spend that much time obsessing on the meta stuff. I want to be a musician, not a marketer of music.
And with that, we have run out of time.
God, really?
Thanks, David. This has been great.
Thank you for having me, both of you. I really enjoyed it. I look forward to seeing you again.
You can follow the Plutopia News Network at plutopia.io. On Facebook, go to @PlutopiaNews. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. With John Lepkoski, I'm Scoop Sweeney. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.